Good morning, everybody. We're talking about the life of Moses, and the life of Moses is recorded in several different places in the scriptures, but the primary account of his life is in the book of Exodus, and the word Exodus means moving out from somewhere. And really, the story of Exodus is it's a freedom story, right? It's a picture of people in bondage and slavery, and they're moving out of that bondage and out of that slavery to freedom. And so my wife shared this video clip of somebody desperately wanting to move out of slavery and bondage to freedom and the joy that they find when they finally arrive there. One smart little cookie.
Не получится.
You can do it. Freedom. Yeah. Huh. That's sort of what it's like, right? We're in, you know, I was the kid. I wasn't smart enough to use my brain in that situation. I just screamed and hollered and begged that someone would deliver me. Some people are smart enough to know how to take things into their own hands, right? Great video. This kid does it with cunning to get out of the crib, and God delivers the Israelites via some plagues that he induces to finally get Pharaoh to relent and let them out of the crib that he's been keeping them in. And that's really what the story of Exodus is really all about at its core. And it's really, you know, if you talk to Jewish people today, they will still tell you that the story that they most identify with in terms of how they see themselves and their relationship to God and the rest of the world is this story of deliverance, about how people were in bondage, and God had promised them this land, and they lived as foreigners and aliens there. And it's interesting, we'll get to chapter 12 in a couple of weeks, and it says 430 years pass from the time when God first appears to Abraham and tells him, your descendants are going to be as numerous as the stars in the sky and the sand on the seashore, and I'm going to give you this land. But it's not going to happen all at once. And literally, in chapter 12, it says 430 days to the day from where God met Abraham, the people finally move out of Egypt towards this homeland that he promised them. And this is
years.
Sorry, thank you, years. Glad I got a voice of correction up here, and it's not in my own head. Thanks, Dan. That's one. I was saying, you'd keep... Are you going to keep score for me up here? You know, so I'm going over stuff with Dan this morning in my office, and every time I talk about Pharaoh, I use the name Moses instead. And Dan goes, who? And I go, Moses. And he goes, no, you're talking about Pharaoh. Wow. It might be a long morning for y'all. I'm sorry. And fortunately, you'll have a scorekeeper to help you out this morning. But it really is. So it's a story about these people moving from bondage to freedom. It's their primary story that they most identify with. And so the story, it's even how they get the name of this book in here. So if you have your bulletins in there, I want you to pull it out, because it's several chapters long, the story of the plagues. And fortunately, you're not going to have to listen to me read all of it this morning. But I do want to read part of it. And you know, so this morning, Rex said, hey, nice new Bible you got there. And so I pulled out off my shelf earlier this week because I was thinking about how I didn't grow up going to church. And I really feel like in my own life, as I was studying and thinking about this, about how I'm not Jewish, but I think this is a story about my life too, about how I didn't grow up going to church, and I started to go to church when I was in high school because a friend invited me, and I didn't want to go to church, but he says there's girls and basketball there, so I started going to church. But I feel like God rescued me when I was in high school. And so this is the first real Bible I had. This is like my family Bible. Some people have really cool, big, thick, leather-bound Bibles. This is my family Bible, 1990, that I got. And so I'm going to read out of it for you, because this is the story of Exodus, moving out of slavery into freedom that I enjoy today is my story too, and I hope that that's yours also, and this morning you'll have the opportunity to reflect and rejoice over the good thing that God's done in each of your lives as well. So in your bulletins there, I'm just going to read part of chapter 6 for you, which is really sort of the precursor to Moses going and demanding of Pharaoh that he release the people that he's held in slavery and used in bondage for his own purposes. So in chapter 6, verse 2, it says, God said to Moses, I'm the Lord. I appeared to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob as God Almighty. But by my name, the Lord, I did not make myself known to them. I also established my covenant with them to give them the land of Canaan, where they lived as aliens. Moreover, I have heard the groaning of the Israelites, whom the Egyptians are enslaving, and I have remembered my covenant. Now, you know, we could just stop here and just, we could just say, this is good news right here, that God hears our groaning. He hears our crying out. When we're suffering, especially unjustly, and we cry out to God, it doesn't fall on deaf ears. Therefore, say to the Israelites, I am the Lord, and I will bring you out from under the yoke of the Egyptians. I will free you from being slaves to them, and I will redeem you with an outstretched arm and a mighty axe of judgment. I will take you as my own people, and I will be your God. Then you will know that I am the Lord your God, who brought you out from under the yoke of the Egyptians, and I will bring you to the land I swore with an uplifted hand to give to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. I will give it to you as a possession. I am the Lord. So Moses, this is good news, right? This is great news. Verse 9. Moses reported this to the Israelites, but they did not listen to him because of their discouragement and cruel bondage. They hear that Moses comes as a leader to their people, and he has been for quite a while. And they recognize him as a leader through a series of events that I won't get into today. But he comes and delivers this great news. And you know what? They are in such a disheartened state that they don't receive it at all. So verse 10, then the Lord said to Moses, go tell Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to let the Israelites go out of the country. And then verse 12, something very familiar to you if you heard Dan's message last week. How does Moses now respond? But Moses said to the Lord, if the Israelites will not listen to me, why would Pharaoh listen to me, since I speak with faltering lips? Like Noah reads with faltering lips, right? A fascinating story here. And it's the precursor to these plagues. And Moses, to his credit, does go and present himself to Pharaoh, and thus this introduces these 10 plagues. Before the 10 plagues, there's really sort of a precursor, and some theologians have said that there's actually 11 plagues, depending how you look at it. Because before the first plague ever comes, God uses Moses to go to him, and in a sense, it's like, you know what? All the pain that Pharaoh and the nation are going to undergo in the coming weeks and months, and possibly over the course of a little more than a year, God comes to him and he gives him an opportunity to spare him all of it. See, if you keep reading in here, in chapter 7, Moses first goes and presents himself to Pharaoh, and this is where he takes the staff that he has, and God commands him, you know, if Pharaoh won't listen to you, throw it on the ground as a sign, and it will become a snake. So Moses goes. If you read on in chapter 7 here, he goes. Moses won't listen to him. He throws the staff on the ground, and it becomes a snake. Oh. Moses goes to Pharaoh. I'm done. Oh, Lord, why would you use me with faltering lips, right? I mean, really, that's how I feel. And So Moses goes to Pharaoh, throws the rod on the ground, and it becomes a snake. Pharaoh is not all that impressed. In fact, Pharaoh, then you know, he calls his assistants and his sorcerers, and they come, and they perform a similar sort of miracle, right? And Pharaoh's like, ha-ha, see, no big deal. But remember what happens there? If you keep reading, yeah, the snake. Thank you. Someone knows this story. I like it, Marlene. I hope you all know this story, right? The snake that Moses throws down consumes and eats all of the other snakes. Now, right away, this is sort of like, the snake, especially the cobra, is more than just a nationalistic symbol to the Egyptians. It was something that they worshipped as a deity. And so in a sense, there's like this immediate confrontation of who's really got the power here. Is it Moses representing this god and my slaves? Or am I in charge? And so he's not all that impressed when the staff is thrown down. But that snake proceeds to consume the other snakes, their nation's snakes. And that should have been the clear sign to Pharaoh right then and there. I might be messing with something that has got more power and more authority than even I have. And remember, at this time, Egypt was probably sort of they were the big kid on the block. They were the bully of the block, man. They had most of the power in the ancient Near East at this time. So Pharaoh really did. He thought of himself as the top dog. But this whole episode with the snakes doesn't even give Pharaoh any pause. And that sort of induces the series of plagues. And the first one is the plague of blood, where Moses comes to Pharaoh and he says, everything that is the Nile, which they worshipped, which was life-giving to everyone, and it's part of why the Egyptians were so powerful, because they had the Nile, the fertility it produced in the land was better than anything else in the ancient Near East, and it enriched them in such a powerful way. And that very source of life is the first thing that undergoes God's judgment as a sign to the people. And it's interesting because as you walk through these, you can kind of see that there's sort of like an order to what happens here, because all the water, everything in the land turns to blood, and the people are reduced to digging alongside the river to try and find fresh water. But as a result of the water turning to blood and all the marshes and everything there, well, what comes out of the water and the marshes? Frogs. They infest the land, and that's the second plague that Moses comes and announces. And the third one, which comes unannounced, but Pharaoh knows what it is the plague of gnats, which come and consume the carcasses of the frogs. And then from that, there are flies that are hatched and an infestation of flies. And this is announced to Pharaoh, and he knows what's coming, and it does come, and it comes in a way that he couldn't even imagine. And as a result of that infestation, there is the parasites end up killing almost all of the livestock in the land. And then from that, even the humans aren't spared, because there's a sixth plague which comes as a surprise, which is the boils to the humans. Even though it's not announced to Pharaoh, Pharaoh knows that it comes. It has something to do with this whole idea. And he goes and he calls Moses and says, let this stuff relent. He says, fine, go away. And he has this epic battle with himself back and forth about letting Moses and the people go and then saying, you know what, I'm not going to give you guys up. Forget it. Forget it. And he keeps saying his heart gets harder. Each one of these, it mentions in the first five how Pharaoh in his heart hardens his heart, not just towards Moses, but towards whoever is behind this infestation that's killing the land. One of the things that people have commented on is, if God wants to make himself known, why doesn't he just, like, open the sky, tear apart the sky and say, Moses, let these people go? Because all of these things, really, they're sort of natural. You know, these are not like the supernatural sort of things that we would expect, miraculous things. These are all God is taking advantage of very natural forces in the world to try and bear Pharaoh's attention that, hey, you need to adjust your course in life. And if you don't, the judgment that's going to come against you is going to devastate not only you, but everyone else around you. Now, here's the thing about this. See, I really think that this is very much how God works to get most of our attentions, is through natural circumstances. And it's our own hardness of heart, and it's our own disobedience in our own lives that brings about so many of the consequences that are devastating to us in our own life. And you know what we come to find out, I think, if we're honest about this? When natural causes come into our own life because of our own pride and arrogance and disobedience and selfishness, you know what? Inevitably, it doesn't just hurt us. But when our lusts and desires control our lives, very oftentimes, other people are casualties of that disobedience. And you can clearly see that that's what ends up happening, that the Moses' hardness of heart and his own pride, it has devastating consequences, not just for him, but for everybody else that he rules over. The next set of plagues are again, they're natural in order, but they're different from the original order. And they come, and they essentially are plagues no longer against just the people directly, but especially against their natural resources, which was their food. And the hail destroys probably about two-thirds of their fields and their crops. But not, fortunately, see, here's the good news. Talk about God's goodness. He doesn't completely devastate the land because some of the harvest ripens later in the year. And so God, even in this trying to get Pharaoh's attention, doesn't completely devastate him, and he still won't listen. Finally, God sends against that last third of the harvest, the locusts, which do consume the rest of the harvest. And if you guys have ever seen, you can look online at pictures of the locusts as they move over the land in the east. And today they don't multiply like they did back then because there isn't as much grain and food product in the Egyptian basin as there used to be. But man, a couple of years ago, in 2004, go online and you can look at the infestation of locusts. And they turned, literally, they turned the sky black for people on the ground for 2.5 days because of the locust infestation. Just crazy. So the land finally is annihilated, and the last thing that comes, and I think it's not only a picture of devastation of the land because light is necessary for living, but I think it's also a picture of the spiritual darkness that Pharaoh was entered into. And darkness consumes the land everywhere except for where God, very oftentimes, he spared Goshen, which is the land where the Israelites live. And there's darkness everywhere. How God did this, I don't know, whether it was as a result of the locusts or not, but darkness permeates the land, and there is no land, no light anywhere. And like I said, I think there's kind of a picture there of spiritual darkness that Pharaoh has entered into because he's so hardened his heart. And he's so pressed himself away from God and responding to the options that God has given him to turn in obedience to him that he's entered into spiritual darkness in his own life. Now, next week, the 10th plague, which I'm not going to talk about, John is going to go into next week, which is the death of the firstborn. Really, some interesting things, and I didn't have room to put this in your bulletin, but it's fascinating to kind of look at an overview of some of these things and how they work together and how you can see how Pharaoh, even whether they were forewarned or not, Pharaoh clearly came to see that each one of these things was from God. And this is an interesting chart, and it'll be online with the rest of our notes and sermon stuff afterwards if you want to look at it. I'm convinced as I read through this story that it seems like a story just of sort of judgment and bad news. And certainly it is a lot of bad news, especially for Pharaoh and the people that he ruled over. But this really is. This is the precursor to the people being set free. And it's a path that they go through, and it's a struggle, and it's not an easy path. And how many of you would say that that's true of your own life too? You'd say that the process of God delivering you from darkness where you were directed by your own ideas and passions in life to moving to a place where you started to genuinely want to enjoy the fruit and the goodness and the peace and the strength that comes from really knowing God. And it would be nice if it was like God could just pixie dust and it just happened, you know? But would you not all say it's a struggle, it's a challenge, daily challenge, to move from that place where darkness consumed our lives because of our own selfish desires to a place where we started to experience the light and the joy of moving towards living in a close relationship to God. And I think that this story is very much like that. Unfortunately, freedom just doesn't come easy. It doesn't come for these people either, despite Moses' obedience. So I want to look at this, and I want to walk through a couple of lessons on the path to freedom here with you. The first one is I want to go back to something that Dan said last week about who are the people that God uses in life to accomplish his work. So I think that there are these rare sort of occasions, you know, where we're like a big challenge comes to us. And you have this sense that my whole life I've been preparing for this moment. Yeah, I feel like God's been directing me my whole life towards this moment. I think that really does happen sometimes. But I think the vast majority of life, what we come to find out is that we're very much like Moses. Even though he had met God at this burning bush, and a lot of time transpires between there and where he first goes to Pharaoh, most of us, in the heat of the moment, when our moment arrives for us, we find out that we not only find that we're unqualified, but we find that we're scared to death to have to do something on God's behalf, to represent him well. And we feel like we're unprepared, and it can't be for us. And it, you know, Dan said this so well. He said, the danger is if you feel like you're qualified to represent God in the biggest moments of life, that is one of the biggest dangers ever, because essentially what most of us do is we trust in our own ability to bring success, to leverage a good outcome. And we think it's because of us and our own strength and the preparation that God has given us. And the truth is, no matter how well prepared you may be, and some of you may be gifted to face that big moment in life, if you're trusting in your own ability, you're misplacing your trust in the outcome. Because here's the thing in life. God never tells Moses. He never says to him, this is on your back, buddy. You go, and it's up to you to convince Pharaoh. He never says that. What God says is, I've got a job for you to go and represent me, whether you feel qualified or not. Very much like Jesus comes to the fishermen and he says to them, these guys are fishermen. These were not the cream of the crop. These were not the people that you would choose to run your business organization. God comes and he says, I've got a job for you, and I'm asking you to go and represent me and allow me to take care of the outcome. That's not in your hands. What God asks us in life is not to determine success or failure. What God asks us to do is to be obedient and allow him to dictate the outcome of these things. And so you can see, this is the thing. I love this about Moses. Three different times he says to God, I don't feel qualified. He's in fear and trembling with the job that God gives him. And yet, he moves forward despite those fears. See, do you ever wonder what faith is like? That is what faith is like. When you feel unprepared, unqualified, are you willing to trust God anyway? Are you willing to move forward in obedience? One of the small ways this works out is, holidays are coming up. And a lot of you are going to have people, you're going to be at people's homes, but especially a lot of you are going to have people in your own homes. And, you may regularly say a prayer before you eat, or say a prayer with your kids before they go to bed, say a prayer with your spouse, whatever. And you're going to have people in your home, and that might not be their custom. But if that's the way your house is organized and that's the way God has called you to live, have some backbone and say, you know what, this may feel uncomfortable for me. I don't like praying out loud. It's hard enough for me to do with my own family. And I've got guests here. This is a weird, uncomfortable moment. Trust God anyways. And do it, because all you're doing is just representing him in the way he called you to live. And that might not be the thing that's going to turn these people's lives around. But don't depend on it to do that. Just depend on saying, I'm willing to do even these sorts of things to represent you well. This is how you've called me to live, God. You know, and you ever think about this in terms of business? So very oftentimes our business world rewards people that cut corners and cut deals and make promises that they don't fulfill. And sometimes that's what helps keep people afloat in business or even enriches people in business. And God says, even though it might not make sense, organize your life and your business with integrity. And trust me that even if you're, see, here's the thing, would you be willing to say, my business may fail if I report all of my taxes? I may lose my job. I may not get this contract that I desperately need. But if you're willing to live with integrity, could you say, you know what, God, you've called me to live with integrity. I'm not going to compromise that. It may cost me my job, but I trust that in the end, whatever I may lose, the bigger loss will come from the loss of my integrity with you and the relationship that I will forfeit because I'm not living honestly with you. And that's the real loss, and that's the thing we can't live well without. See, and that leads to the second point, which is it's so hard sometimes. I'd love to stand up here and tell you. I'd love this as a pastor to say, you know what? Obey God and he's going to bless you. It's all going to go well with you every time you do it. And see, stories like this, they help you see that Moses was obedient. And it gets harder for him to be obedient to go back to Pharaoh time after time. And I'd love to say, see how well this works out for Moses? The people love him. Everybody loves him. And he gets rich as a result of this. And you know what, man? Moses' life is hard. And obedience is hard. And it can cost us a lot. And we're not always guaranteed prosperity on earth. But a far bigger thing that you'll forfeit in lacking obedience is that ability to be able to enjoy the peace and strength that comes from a relationship with God. And in America, our lives and our world is so based on material and material outcomes and pleasing other people and trying to stay in good graces with other people that very oftentimes we will do all of those things at the expense of forfeiting our lives and our relationship with God. And then people will come to me in my office and they will say, Noah, how come I don't feel God's presence in my life? You know, I could tell you, it's natural law, just like you see in the plagues and the consequences of them. If you don't work towards cultivating a rich relationship with God, you won't have it. It's natural laws and spiritual laws. They work the same. And you can't disregard natural law and think that everything's going to go well in life. You can't jump off a building and think, this is going to be great fun. Because gravity, natural law is going to take over. It's going to be a painful experience for you. You can't disobey spiritual realities and think that it's going to go well for you either. The other thing that, you know, the Bible, sometimes we talk about how patient God is and how good he is. There is nowhere, I think, in the entire Bible that you're going to find a bigger picture of how good God is as you work through what seems like a devastating set of circumstances in the plagues, but they also represent something bigger as you look at the umbrella of them. It just, look how good God is. Why doesn't he just smite Pharaoh right away? When he has the hubris, when he has the pride and the arrogance to disregard the snake thing, why doesn't God just smite him then? The patience in which God deals with Pharaoh is nothing more than astounding. And it's interesting because I wish that God would act right away when I have something I want him to do. But I also see, I work with this tension in my life where I'm grateful that God doesn't smite me. Right? I mean, when I want justice, I want it right now. But I don't want God's justice right now for me. There's times where I'm really disappointed that God doesn't work faster. But when it comes to myself, I want that sort of grace and patience. And you can see that in this, that the people want, and Moses, they want justice right away. 430 years will pass from the time of Abraham to the time where these people will really start moving towards freedom. And God is so good and so gracious, and he's given humanity, and he's given each one of us, the fact that each one of us is still here breathing today and got up this morning, is nothing more than a picture of God's sheer grace and goodness. Because how many of you would say, like Pharaoh, I don't have it all together, and I've rejected getting it all together. And yet, here I am. Here I am. Wow. And yet, you also see in this that God's good patience, it does have its limits. And even with Pharaoh, as he commits to hardening his heart against God, those chances, and we don't know how many chances we're going to have in our own lives. And this is why Jesus and Paul implores you. He says, today is the day of salvation. Don't wait and hope that tomorrow you'll have the opportunity to start responding to God. Do it today. Do it today. Because you don't know when those opportunities are going to come to their end. So it's interesting because at the end of the sixth plague, in verse 12, it says, but the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart that he would not listen to Moses and Aaron, just as the Lord had said to Moses. See, God now is intervening even in the heart of Moses to further harden the hardening that Moses, that Pharaoh has already begun. C.S. Lewis talks about this whole venture of how do people end up living for eternity apart from God? How do people end up in hell? How does that happen? And he addresses this so well in one in an essay called God in the Dock, and this is sort of a takeoff on his work, his book, The Great Divorce. And he says, it's not a question of God sending us to hell. In each of us, there's something growing which will be hell unless it's nipped in the bud. And you know what you can see really clearly here, can't you? In Pharaoh's case, what is that? It's his pride. And it's his pride that eventually will not only alienate him from Moses and Aaron, which is his lifeline, but it ultimately it'll alienate him from God for eternity. And it's funny because you can see in this the slow progression of him moving in that direction, where Lewis in Screwtape Letters says, the safest road to hell is the gradual one. You just sort of want to slip into that place. You know, Satan doesn't want you to reject God outright at the beginning. The best way to get people to completely reject God is just by a slow, steady progress. And you know, the funny thing about this is even though God is now at work in Pharaoh's heart, Pharaoh still has free will, and he still is battling this whole thing. Listen to what he says in verse chapter 9, near the end of the plagues. Pharaoh, listen to what he says here. He knows somewhere inside, despite all of this. Pharaoh summoned Moses and Aaron, and he said, this time I've sinned, he said. The Lord is in the right, my people, we're in the wrong. And then the next chapter even says, now forgive my sins. What's he say? Once more. Pharaoh, in spite of all of the direct pushing away from God that he's done, and even God sort of intervening, starting to cut his heartstrings, he's still got this wrestling match. And you know, I want to tell you what this is from in his life. And this is why freedom is so difficult for you and I to get in our lives. Because we build our self-identity and self-worth on something other than God and his goodness. Pharaoh knows he's gotten rich. And part of the power that he enjoys in life comes as a result of this huge workforce he has. And that's so central to what makes him who he is and the power that he enjoys. And although the answer is for him, for freedom, for relief from judgment, is to let the people go, he just can't bring himself to let go of that thing that he most strongly identifies with. Man, oh man, is that not the truth? Of so many of our lives, we build our lives on something other than Christ. And we, even when we come face to face with him, we know it, and we can even admit it, to let go of it can be so hard. And man, oh man, is that not what he wrestles with right here? So, you know, I think that immediately when we read this story, there's this sense that most of us want to identify with Moses. We think of ourselves from Moses from the perspective, I go out and I tell other people about God, or I do my best to represent God well, and we think, you know, other people have rejected my words and they've rejected God. And a lot of us identify very strongly with Moses in this whole account. But I want to challenge you to think that maybe that's not really who most of our lives are most like. I'll tell you, when I first started doing primarily adult ministry here, I had always told people that the reason I loved youth, being a youth pastor for 16 years, I did, and I loved it, and I still love it today, is because, you know, the thing I like about kids, and even junior hires, which is wild and out of control as they are, right, bouncing off the walls, there's a sense in which when you sit down with them, they're still willing to sort of think about life, think about what they're doing, what they want their life to look like, and what their choices are all about. And it's funny because, you know, like, you ever think about what we lose as we grow older? Like when you're little, you have this desire to know about the world. You have this thirst and this hunger, and you ask questions. Some dumb, some really good, but you have a thirst to know and understand the world around you. And as we get older, what happens? We start asking less questions, especially good questions. And when I ask you all out here, I go, is it good or bad that we stop asking questions as we get older? I think 95, 99% of you are going to say, it's kind of sad that we lose that ability to keep having that sense of wonder about the world. But we do. But most of us would say that's a sad thing. See, I would tell you that it's just as sad that as we get older, most of us stop wanting to think about life and our direction and the choices we make and where they're leading us. See, that the thing I loved about youth ministry was kids were still thinking about that stuff. And I felt like, although it was really hard, I could help them make choices to sort of align their lives with God's purposes. And it's not just working with adults that's convinced me that we stop doing that, but I see it in my own life too. And though God very oftentimes makes clear to me where I'm out of step or out of alignment, in direct disobedience to Him, I don't have a heart or an inclination to do anything about it. And you know what ends up happening? As a result of rejecting God's voice in my life, see, once you start rejecting God's voice in your life and His direction in your life in one significant area, you can be sure that it's going to be harder and harder to hear Him in all areas of life. That there's this law, this natural law that happens in our life when we start rejecting God and His leading. And that's why I would implore you that in order to escape this hardness of heart and this ability to be able to escape our own, whatever our sin is, and so you can see in Pharaoh's life, it's pride. We all read this story, and it's so evident to us, right? Just like you can look in your friend's life, in your wife's life, in your husband's life, in your kid's life, in your coworker's life, and you can identify what owns them. But we suck at doing it in our own lives. And it's even worse, even when we know what it is, it's like gravity and it sucks us in. And see, unless we have a soft heart, and we implore God to help me stay in the fight, that's the only way to escape that gravity. And that's the only hope we have to be able to start moving away from that thing which consumes and eats our lives, that we'll end up in judgment on our lives and our relationships and our ability to grow close to God and enjoy Him forever. Pharaoh is such a good warning for us to avoid that hardness of heart. The last thing in here is there's a temptation to just think this story is about Moses and Pharaoh and God and sort of this battle. It's interesting, though, because there's notes as you read through here carefully, and you see it's not just about them. So in the middle of the seventh plague, and I'll tell you also in the ninth plague, Pharaoh's officials come to Pharaoh, who's God to them. Pharaoh's officials come, and they confront him and say, "You're killing us." And his own officials tell him, "Let these people go." Pharaoh's own friends finally own up to the challenge of going and telling him. But notice what Moses and Aaron say to Pharaoh after the seventh plague. They say, "Give an order now to bring your livestock, everything you have in from the field, to a place of shelter, because the hail will fall on every man and every animal as has not been brought in and still out in the field, and they will die." Those officials of Pharaoh who feared the word of the Lord hurried. They moved quickly to bring in their slaves and their livestock inside to save them from the judgment that was coming. You know, I think that removing ourselves out of the Exodus story and this immediate story just for a minute, just to draw sort of a parallel for you and I think that there's a sense in which this is true for everybody. Judgment will come upon the world, and judgment because of sin will come upon us. But God not only warns us, he tells us where we can get shelter for ourselves to find salvation. And it would be nice if we could plead with God and say, "I've been good enough, let me escape judgment. Or let it come on other people, but not me." It would be nice if we could somehow, like, by our own power, push that judgment away. Right? Say, don't, you know, this idea of sin and death, it's for other people, not for me. It'd be nice if we could save ourselves from God's judgment. But very much like this hail, Moses comes and he says to Pharaoh, "Ain't nothing going to stop it. It's coming. It's going to be devastating. But there's a way of salvation. There's good news for you. You can avoid this. Everybody can escape it. All you got to do is just move. Move to the shelter that I provide." Man, you know, this is the message for the world today. Because of sin, judgment will come upon the world, and it will come upon everyone who doesn't take shelter. And God's given us the place to do it. And that shelter is in his son, Jesus. And that's the sure place where we can all find salvation from judgment for sin. It's the one sure shelter that we can all enjoy in life. And like Moses does with Pharaoh, think of how frustrated this poor guy was. Can you imagine? You know, nobody likes beating their head against the wall. Nobody. But Moses and Aaron, they know the truth. And they implore Pharaoh, "Come in. Save yourself. Lay down this thing that's killing you. And come be saved." I'm convinced that God has that message for you and I too. To go out and share with other people. It's not just beating our heads against the wall, but we want other people to be and enjoy the shelter that God offers from the storm of judgment. Lord, thanks for your goodness. And thanks for just your vast store of patience throughout history, in the story even with Pharaoh, and the patience you have with us. Lord, I'd ask that your Holy Spirit would give us a soft heart to want to be able to hear you and move away from the poison that consumes us, that drags us in, that makes us think that life is about something other than you. To be able to find that real joy and peace that comes not from our circumstance or even our earthly relationships, but comes from living with integrity with you. Let that be our strength today. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.